The Wanling Record of the Zen Master Wangbo, recorded by Peixiu during his tenure at the prefecture of Wanling. Sections 27 through 56, The Anecdotes. Translated by John Blofeld. Read by Essential Salts. 27. Our master came originally from Fujian, but took his vows upon Mount Huangbo in this prefecture while he was still very young. In the center of his forehead was a small lump shaped like a pearl. His voice was soft and agreeable, his character unassuming and placid. Some years after his ordination, while journeying to Mount Tiandai, he fell in with a monk with whom he soon came to feel like an old acquaintance. So they continued their journey together. Finding the way barred by a mountain stream in flood, our master leant upon his staff and halted, at which his friend entreated him to proceed. "No, you go first," said our master. So the former floated his big straw rain hat on the torrent and easily made his way to the other side. "I," sighed the master, "have allowed such a fellow to accompany me. I ought to have slain him with a blow of my staff." 28. Once, a certain monk, on taking leave of Master Kui Sung, was asked where he intended to go. "I intend to visit all the places where the five kinds of Zen are taught," he replied. "Oh," exclaimed Kui Sung, "other places may have five kinds. Here, we have only the one kind." But when the monk inquired what it was, he received a sudden blow. "I see, I see," he shouted excitedly. "Speak, speak," roared Kui Sung. So the monk got ready to say something further, but just at that moment, he received another blow. Afterwards, this same monk arrived at our master's monastery, and, being asked by Huangbo where he had come from, explained that he had recently left Kui Sung. "And what instructions did you receive from him?" inquired our master, whereupon the monk related the above story. During the next assembly, our master took this anecdote for his text and said, "Master Kui Sung really excels the 84 deeply enlightened ones. The questions people ask are all of them no better than stinking muck saturating the ground. There is only Kui Sung who is worth something." 29. Our master once attended an assembly at the Bureau of the Imperial Salt Commissioners, at which the Emperor Taichung was also present as a Sramanera. The Sramanera noticed our master enter the hall of worship and make a triple prostration to the Buddha, whereupon he asked, "If we are to seek nothing from the Buddha, Dharma, or Sangha, what does your reverence seek by such prostrations?" "Though I seek not from the Buddha," replied our master, "or from the Dharma, or from the Sangha, it is my custom to show respect in this way." "But what purpose does it serve?" insisted the Sramanera, whereupon he suddenly received a slap. "Oh," he exclaimed, "how uncouth you are." "What is this?" cried the master. "Imagine making a distinction between refined and uncouth." So saying, he administered another slap, causing the Sramanera to betake himself elsewhere. 30. During his travels, our master paid a visit to Nanchuan, his senior. One day, at dinner time, he took his bowl and seated himself opposite Nanchuan's high chair. Noticing him there, Nanchuan stepped down to receive him and asked, "How long has your reverence been following the way?" "Since before the era of Bhisma Raja," came the reply. "Indeed," exclaimed Nanchuan. "It seems that Master Ma has a worthy grandson here." Our master then walked quietly away. A few days later, when our master was going out, Nanchuan remarked, "You are such a huge man, so why wear a hat of such ridiculous size?" "Ah, Well, replied our master, it contains vast numbers of chiliocosms. Well, what of me? Inquired Nanchuan. But the master put on his hat and walked off.
31. Another day, our master was seated in the tea room when Nanchuan came down and asked him, what is meant by a clear insight into the Buddha nature results from the study of jhana and prajna? Our master replied, it means that from morning till night we should never rely on a single thing. Nanchuan said, but isn't that just your reverence's own concept of its meaning? Our master replied, how could I be so presumptuous? Nanchuan said, well, your reverence, some people might pay out cash for rice water, but whom could you ask to give anything for a pair of homemade straw sandals like that? At this, our master remained silent. Later, Weishan mentioned the incident to Yangshan, inquiring if our master's silence betokened defeat. Oh no, answered Yang. Surely you know that Huangbo has a tiger's cunning. Indeed, there's no limit to your profundity, exclaimed the other. 32. Once, our master requested a short leave of absence, and Nanshan asked where he was going. I'm just off to gather some vegetables, our master said. What are you going to cut them with? Nanshan asked. Our master held up his knife, whereupon Nanshan remarked, well, that's all right for a guest, but not for a host. Our master showed his appreciation with a triple prostration. 33. One day, five new arrivals presented themselves to our master in a group. One of them, instead of making the customary prostration, remained standing and greeted him somewhat casually with a motion of his clasped hands. And do you know how to be a good hunting dog? Inquired our master. I must follow the antelope's scent, replied the student. Suppose it leaves no scent. What will you follow then? Our master asked. Then I'd follow its hoof marks, replied the student. And if there were no hoof marks, what then? Our master inquired further. I could still follow the animal's tracks, said the student. But what if there were not even tracks? How would you follow it then? Asked the master. In that case, said the newcomer, it would surely be a dead antelope. Our master said nothing more at the time, but on the following morning, after his sermon, he asked, will yesterday's antelope-hunting monk now step forward? The monk complied, and our master inquired, yesterday, my reverend friend, you were left without anything to say. How was that? Finding that the other returned no answer, he continued, ah, you may call yourself a real monk, but you are just an amateur novice. 34. Once, when our master had just dismissed the first of the daily assemblies at the Kai Yuan Monastery near Hengqiu, I happened to enter its precincts. Presently, I noticed a wall painting, and by questioning the monk in charge of the monastery's administration, learnt that it portrayed a certain famous monk. Indeed, I said. Yes, I can see his likeness before me. But where is the man himself? My question was received in silence. So I remarked, but surely there are Zen monks here in this temple, aren't there? Yes, replied the monastery administrator. There is one. After that, I requested an audience with the master and repeated to him my recent conversation. Patio! Cried the master. Sir, I answered respectfully. Where are you? Realizing that no reply was possible to such a question, I hastened to ask our master to re-enter the hall and continue his sermon. 35. When the master had taken his place in the assembly hall, he began, "You people are just like drunkards. I don't know how you manage to keep on your feet in such a sodden condition. Why, everyone will die of laughing at you. It all seems so easy, so why do we have to live to see a day like this? Can't you understand that in the whole empire of Tang, there are no teachers skilled in Zen?" At this point, one of the monks present asked, "How can you say that? At this very moment, as all can see, we are sitting face to face with one who has appeared in the world to be a teacher of monks and a leader of men. Please note that I did not say there is no Zen," answered our master. "I merely pointed out that there are no teachers." Later, Wei Shan reported this conversation to Yangshan and asked what it implied. Said Yangshan, "That swan is able to extract the pure milk from the unadulterated mixture. It is very clear that he is not just an ordinary duck." "Ah," responded the other. "Yes, the point he made was very subtle." 36. One day, I brought a statue of the Buddha, and kneeling respectfully before our master, begged him to bestow upon me a sacred honorific. "Peisho!" he cried. "Yes, master." "How is it that you still concern yourself with names?" All I could do was to prostrate myself in silence. And there was another time when I offered our master a poem I had written. He took it in his hands, but soon sat down and pushed it away. "Do you understand?" he asked. "No, master." "But why don't you understand? Think a little. If things could be expressed like this with ink and paper, what would be the purpose of a sect like ours?" My poem ran as follows. When his master bequeathed him mind intuition, he of great height with a pearl on his forehead, dwelt for 10 years by the river in Sichuan. Now like a chalice borne by the waters, he has come to rest on the banks of the Chang. 1,000 disciples follow behind him, with Dragon Mian glorious bearing the fragrance of flowers from afar. These are aspirant Buddhas, yet desiring to serve him humbly as pupils. Who knows upon which the transmission will fall? Our master later replied with another poem. Mind is a mighty ocean, a sea which knows no bounds. Words are but scarlet lotus to cure the lesser ills. Though there be times of leisure when my hands both lie at rest, 'tis not to welcome idlers that I raise them to my breast. 37. Our master said, "Those who desire progress along the way must first cast out the dross acquired through heterogeneous learning. Above all, they must avoid seeking for anything objective or permitting themselves any sort of attachment. Having listened to the profoundest doctrines, they must behave as though a light breeze had caressed their ears, a gust had passed away in the blink of an eye. By no means may they attempt to follow such doctrines. To act in accordance with these injunctions is to achieve profundity. The motionless contemplation of the Tathagatas implies the Zen-mindedness of one who has left the round of birth and death forever. From the days when Bodhidharma first transmitted naught but the one mind, there has been no other valid Dharma." Pointing to the identity of mind and the Buddha, he demonstrated how the highest forms of enlightenment could be transcended. Assuredly, he left no other thought but this: "If you wish to enter by the gate of our sect, this must be your only Dharma. If you expect to gain anything from teachers of other doctrines, what is your purpose in coming here? So it is said that if you have the merest intention to indulge in conceptual thinking, behold, your very intention will place you in the clutch of demons. Similarly, a conscious lack of such intention or even a consciousness that you do not have no such intention, will be sufficient to deliver you into the demon's power. But they will not be demons from outside. They will be the self-creations of your own mind. The only reality is that bodhisattva, whose existence is totally unmanifested, even in a spiritual sense, the trackless one. If ever you should allow yourselves to believe in the more than purely transitory existence of phenomena, you will have fallen into a grave error known as the heretical belief in eternal life. But if, on the contrary, you take the intrinsic voidness of phenomena to imply mere emptiness, then you will have fallen into another error, the heresy of total extinction. Thus, the triple world is only mind, the myriad phenomena are only consciousness, is the sort of thing taught to people who previously maintained even falser views and suffered from even graver errors of perception. Similarly, the doctrine that the Dharmakaya is something attained only after reaching full enlightenment was merely intended as a means of converting the Theravadin saints from graver errors. Finding these mistaken views prevalent, Gautama Buddha refuted two sorts of misunderstanding: the notions that enlightenment will lead to the perception of a universal substance composed of particles which some hold to be gross and others subtle. How is it possible that Gautama Buddha, who denied all such views as those I have mentioned, could have originated the present conceptions of enlightenment? But as these doctrines are still commonly taught, people become involved in the duality of longing for light and eschewing darkness. And their anxiety to seek enlightenment on the one hand, and to escape from the passions and ignorance of corporeal existence on the other, they conceive of an enlightened Buddha and unenlightened sentient beings as separate entities. Continued indulgence in such dualistic concepts as these will lead to your rebirth among the six orders of beings, life after life, eon upon eon, forever and forever. And why is it thus? Because of falsifying the doctrine that the original source of the Buddhas is that self-existent nature. Let me assure you again that the Buddha dwells not in light, nor sentient beings in darkness, for the truth allows no such distinctions. The Buddha is not mighty, nor sentient beings feeble, for the truth allows no such distinctions. The Buddha is not enlightened, nor sentient beings ignorant, for the truth allows no such distinctions. It is all because you take it upon yourself to talk of explaining Zen. As soon as the mouth is opened, evils spring forth. People either neglect the root and speak of the branches, or neglect the reality of the illusory world and speak only of enlightenment. Or else they chatter of cosmic activities leading to transformations, while neglecting the substance from which they spring. Indeed, there is never any profit in discussion. Once more, all phenomena are basically without existence, though you cannot now say that they are non-existent. Karma, having arisen, does not thereby exist. Karma destroyed does not thereby cease to exist. Even its root does not exist, for that root is no root. Moreover, mind is not mind, for whatever that term connotes is far from the reality it symbolizes. Form, too, is not really form. So if I now state that there are no phenomena and no original mind, you will begin to understand something of the intuitive Dharma silently conveyed to mind with mind. Since phenomena and no phenomena are one, there is neither phenomena nor no phenomena, and the only possible transmission is to mind with mind. When a sudden flash of thought occurs in your mind, and you recognize it for a dream or an illusion, then you can enter into the state reached by the Buddhas of the past. Not that the Buddhas of the past really exist, or that the Buddhas of the future have not yet come into existence. Above all, have no longing to become a future Buddha. Your sole concern should be, as thought succeeds thought, to avoid clinging to any of them. Nor may you entertain the least ambition to be a Buddha here and now. Even if a Buddha arises, do not think of him as enlightened or deluded, good or evil. Hasten to rid yourself of any desire to cling to him. Cut him off in the twinkling of an eye. On no account seek to hold him fast, for 1,000 locks could not stay him, nor 100,000 feet of rope bind him. This being so, valiantly strive to banish and annihilate him. I will now make luminously clear how to set about being rid of that Buddha. Consider the sunlight. You may say it is near, yet if you follow it from world to world, you will never catch it in your hands. Then you may describe it as far away, and lo, you will see it just before your eyes. Follow it, and behold, it escapes you. Run from it, and it follows you close. You can neither possess it, nor have done with it. From this example, you can understand how it is with the true nature of all things, and henceforth, there will be no need to grieve or to worry about such things. Now, beware of going on to say that my recommendation to cut off the Buddha was profane, or that my comparing him to the sunshine was pious, as though I had wavered from one extreme to the other. Followers of the other sects would then agree with you, but our Zen sect will not admit either the profanity of the first nor the pious quality of the second. Nor do we regard the first as Buddha-like, or the second as something to be expected only from ignorant sentient beings. Thus, all the visible universe is the Buddha. So are all sounds. Hold fast to one principle, and all the others are identical. On seeing one thing, you see all. On perceiving any individual's mind, you are perceiving all mind. Obtain a glimpse of one way, and all ways are embraced in your vision, for there is nowhere at all which is devoid of the way. When your glance falls upon a grain of dust, what you see is identical with all the vast world systems with their great rivers and mighty hills. To gaze upon a drop of water is to behold the nature of all the waters of the universe. Moreover, in thus contemplating the totality of phenomena, you are contemplating the totality of mind. All these phenomena are intrinsically void, and yet this mind with which they are identical is no mere nothingness. By this I mean that it does exist, but in a way too marvelous for us to comprehend. It is an existence which is no existence, a non-existence which is nevertheless existence. So this true void does, in some marvelous way, exist. According to what has been said, we can encompass all the vast world systems, though numberless as grains of sand, with our one mind. Then, why talk of inside and outside? Honey, having the invariable characteristic of sweetness, it follows that all honey is sweet. To speak of this honey as sweet and that honey as bitter would be nonsensical. How could it be so? Hence we say that the void has no inside and no outside. There is only the spontaneously existing Bhutatattva. And, for this same reason, we say it has no center. There is only the spontaneously existing Bhutatattva. Thus, sentient beings are the Buddha. The Buddha is one with them. Both consist entirely of the one substance, the phenomenal universe and nirvana, activity and motionless placidity, all are of the one substance. So also are the worlds, and with the state that transcends the worlds. Yes, the beings passing through the six stages of existence, those who have undergone the four kinds of birth, the vast world systems with their mountains and rivers, the Bodhi nature, and delusion. All of them are thus. By saying that they are all of one substance, we mean that their names and forms, their existence and non-existence, are void. The great world systems, uncountable as Ganges sands, are in truth comprised in the one boundless void. Then, where can there be Buddhas who deliver, or sentient beings to be delivered? When the true nature of all things that exist is an identical thusness, how can such distinctions have any reality? If you suppose that phenomena arise of themselves, you will fall into the heresy of regarding things as having a spontaneous existence of their own. On the other hand, if you accept the doctrine of Anatman, the concept Anatman may land you among the Theravadins. You people seek to measure all within the void, foot by foot and inch by inch. I repeat to you that all phenomena are devoid of distinctions of form. Intrinsically, they belong to that perfect tranquility which lies beyond the transitory sphere of form-producing activities. So all of them are coexistent with space and one with reality. Since no bodies possess real form, we speak of phenomena as void. And since mind is formless, we speak of the nature of all things as void. Both are formless, and both are termed void. Moreover, none of the numerous doctrines has any existence outside your original mind. All this talk of Bodhi, Nirvana, the Absolute, the Buddha nature, Mahayana, Theravada, Bodhisattvas, and so on, is like taking autumn leaves for gold. To use the symbol of the closed fist, when it is opened, all beings, both gods and men, will perceive there is not a single thing inside. Therefore, it is written, there's never been a single thing. Then where's defiling dust to cling? If there's never been a single thing, past, present, and future are meaningless. So those who seek the way must enter it with the suddenness of a knife thrust. Full understanding of this must come before they can enter. Hence, though Bodhidharma traversed many countries on his way from India to China, he encountered only one man, the Venerable Ko, to whom he could silently transmit the mind seal, the seal of your own real mind. Phenomena are the seal of mind, just as the latter is the seal of phenomena. Whatever mind is, so also are phenomena. Both are equally real and partake equally of the Dharma nature which hangs in the void. He who receives an intuition of this truth has become a Buddha and attained to the Dharma. Let me repeat that enlightenment cannot be bodily grasped, for the body is formless, nor mentally grasped, for the mind is formless, nor grasped through its essential nature, since that nature is the original source of all things, the real nature of all things, permanent reality of Buddha. How can you use the Buddha to grasp the Buddha, formlessness to grasp formlessness, mind to grasp mind, void to grasp void, the way to grasp the way? In reality, there is nothing to be grasped. Even not grasping cannot be grasped. So it is said, there is nothing to be grasped. We simply teach you how to understand your original mind. Moreover, when the moment of understanding comes, do not think in terms of understanding, not understanding, or not understanding, for none of these is something to be grasped. This Dharma of thusness, when grasped, is grasped. But he who grasps it is no more conscious of having done so than someone ignorant of it is conscious of his failure. Ah, this Dharma of thusness! Until now, so few people have come to understand it that it is written, in this world, how few are they who lose their egos. As for those people who seek to grasp it through the application of some particular principle, or by creating a special environment, or through scripture, or doctrine, or age, or time, or name, or word, or through their six senses, how do they differ from wooden dolls? But if, unexpectedly, one man were to appear, one who formed no concept based on any name or form, I assure you that this man might be sought through world after world, always in vain. His uniqueness would assure him of succeeding to the patriarch's place and earn for him the name of Shakyamuni's true spiritual son. The conflicting aggregates of his ego self would have vanished, and he would indeed be the one. Therefore, it is written, when the king attains to Buddhahood, the princes accordingly leave their home to become monks. Hard is the meaning of this saying. It is to teach you to refrain from seeking Buddhahood, since any search is doomed to failure. Some madman shrieking on the mountaintop, on hearing the echo far below, may go to seek it in the valley. But oh, how vain his search! Once in the valley, he shrieks again, and straightway climbs to search among the peaks. Why, he may spend 1,000 rebirths, or 10,000 eons, searching for the source of those sounds and their echoes. How vainly will he breast the troubled waters of life and death? Far better that you make no sound, for then will there be no echo. And thus it is with the dwellers in Nirvana. No listening, no knowing, no sound, no track, no trace. Make yourselves thus, and you will be scarcely less than neighbors of Bodhidharma. 38. Question. Pray instruct me concerning the passage in the sutras denying the existence of a sword of thusness in the royal treasury. Answer. The royal treasury is the nature of the void. Though all the vast world systems of the universe are contained therein, none of them have existence outside your mind. Another name for it is the Bodhisattva treasury of the great void. If you speak of it as existing or not existing, or as neither the one nor the other, in every case it becomes a mere ram's horn. It is a ram's horn in the sense that you have made it an object of your useless search. 39. Question. But is there not a sword of truth within the royal treasury? Answer. Another ram's horn. Question. Yet if there is no sword of truth, why is it written, the prince seized the sword of truth from the royal treasury and set out upon his conquests? Why do you tell us nothing of it beyond denying its objective existence? Answer. The prince who took the sword connotes a true spiritual son of the Tathagata. But if you say that he carried it off, you imply that he deprived the treasury of something. What nonsense it is to speak of carrying off a piece of that void nature, which is the source of all things. It would appear that, if you have got hold of anything at all, it may be called a collection of ram's horns. 40. Question. When Kashyapa received the seal of Buddhahood from Gautama Buddha, did he make use of words during its further transmission? Answer. Yes. Question. Then, since he attempted its transmission in words, even he should be included among the people with ram's horns. Answer. Kashyapa obtained a direct self-realization of original mind, so he is not one of those with horns. Whosoever obtains this direct realization of the Tathagata mind, thereby understanding the true identity of the Tathagata and perceiving his real appearance and real form, can speak to others with the authority of the Buddha's true spiritual son. But Ananda, though he served his master for 20 years, was unable to perceive more than his outward appearance and form, and was therefore admonished by the Buddha in these words. Those who concentrate entirely upon helping the world cannot escape from among the horned ones. 41. Question. What is the meaning of the passage, Manjushri stood before Gotama with a drawn sword? Answer. The 500 bodhisattvas attained knowledge of their previous lives and discovered how their previous karma had been constructed. This is a fable in which the 500 really refers to your five senses. On account of their knowledge of their previous karma, they sought the Buddha, Bodhisattvahood, and Nirvana objectively. It was for this reason that Manjushri took up the sword of Bodhi and used it to destroy the concept of a tangible Buddha, and it is for this that he is known as the destroyer of human virtues. Question: what does the sword really signify? Answer: it signifies the apprehension of mind. Question: so the sword used to destroy the concept of a tangible Buddha is the apprehension of mind. Well then, if we are able to put an end to such concepts by this means, how is their destruction actually accomplished? Answer: you must use that wisdom which comes from non-dualism to destroy your concept-forming dualistic mentality. Question: assuming that the concepts of something perceptible and of enlightenment as something to be sought can be destroyed by drawing the sword of non-discriminatory wisdom, where precisely is such a sword to be found? Answer: since non-discriminatory wisdom is the destroyer both of perception and of its opposite, it must also belong to the non-perceptible. Question: knowledge cannot be used to destroy knowledge, nor a sword to destroy a sword. Answer: sword does destroy sword. They destroy each other. And no sword remains for you to grasp. Knowledge does destroy knowledge. This knowledge invalidates that knowledge, and then no knowledge remains for you to grasp. It is as though mother and son perished together. 42. Question: what is implied by seeing into the real nature? Answer: that nature and your perception of it are one. You cannot use it to see something over and above itself. That nature and your hearing of it are one. You cannot use it to hear something over and above itself. If you form a concept of the true nature of anything as being visible or audible, you allow a dharma of distinction to arise. Let me repeat that the perceived cannot perceive. Can there, I ask you, be a head attached to the crown of your head? I will give you an example to make my meaning clearer. Imagine some loose pearls in a bowl, some large globules and some small. Each one is completely unaware of the others, and none causes the least obstruction to the rest. During their formation, they did not say, "Now I am coming into being." And when they begin to decay, they will not say, "Now I am decaying." None of the beings born into the six forms of life through the four kinds of birth are exceptions to this rule. Buddhas and sentient creatures have no mutual perception of each other. The four grades of Theravadin adepts who are able to enter Nirvana do not perceive, nor are they perceived by Nirvana. Those Theravadins who have reached the three stages of holiness and who possess the 10 excellent characteristics neither perceive nor are perceived by enlightenment. So it is with everything else, down to fire and water, or earth and sky. These pairs of elements have no mutual perception of each other. Sentient beings do not enter the Dharma Dhatu, nor do the Buddhas issue from it. There is no coming and going within the Dharmata, nor anything perceptible. This being so, why this talk of "I see," "I hear," "I receive an intuition through enlightenment," "I hear the Dharma from the lips of an enlightened one," or of Buddhas appearing in the world to preach the Dharma? Katyayana was rebuked by Vimalakirti for using that transitory mentality which belongs to the ephemeral state to transmit the doctrine of the real existence of matter. I assure you that all things have been free from bondage since the very beginning. So why attempt to explain them? Why attempt to purify what has never been defiled? Therefore, it is written, "The absolute is thusness, How can it be discussed? You people still conceive of mind as existing or not existing, as pure or defiled, as something to be studied in the way that one studies a piece of categorical knowledge, or as a concept. Any of these definitions is sufficient to throw you back into the endless round of birth and death. The man who perceives things always wants to identify them, to get a hold on them. Those who use their minds like eyes in this way are sure to suppose that progress is a matter of stages. If you are that kind of person, you are as far from the truth as earth is far from heaven. Why this talk of seeing into your own nature? 43. Question. You say that our original nature and the act of seeing into it are one and the same. This can only be so if that nature is totally undifferentiated. Pray explain how it is that, even allowing that there are no real objects for us to perceive, nevertheless we do in fact see what is near to us and are unable to see what is far away. Answer. This is due to a misunderstanding arising from your own delusions. You cannot argue that the universal nature does in fact contain real objects on the grounds that no real objects to be perceived would only be true if there were nothing of the kind we call perceptible. The nature of the absolute is neither perceptible nor imperceptible, and with phenomena it is just the same. But to one who has discovered his real nature, how can there be anywhere or anything separate from it? Thus, the six forms of life, arising from the four kinds of birth, together with the great world systems of the universe, with their rivers and mountains, are all of one pure substance with our own nature. Therefore, it is said, the perception of a phenomenon is the perception of the universal nature, since phenomena and mind are one and the same. It is only because you cling to outward forms that you come to see, hear, feel, and know things as individual entities. True perception is beyond your powers so long as you indulge in these. By such means, you will fall among the followers of the usual Mahayana and Theravadin doctrines who rely upon deep perception to arrive at a true understanding. Therefore, they see what is near and fail to see what is far away. But no one on the right path thinks thus. I assure you, there is no inner or outer or near or far. The fundamental nature of all phenomena is close beside you, but you do not see even that. Yet you still go on talking of your inability to see what is far away. What meaning can this sort of talk possibly have? 44. Question. What guidance does your reverence offer to those of us who find all this very difficult to understand? Answer. I have no thing to offer. I have never had anything to offer others. It is because you allow certain people to lead you astray that you are forever seeking intuition and searching for understanding. Isn't this a case of disciples and teachers all falling into the same insoluble muddle? All you need to remember are the following injunctions. First, learn how to be entirely unreceptive to sensations arising from external forms, thereby purging your bodies of receptivity to externals. Second, learn not to pay attention to any distinctions between this and that arising from your sensations, thereby purging your bodies of useless discernments between one phenomenon and another. Third, take great care to avoid discriminating in terms of pleasant and unpleasant sensations, thereby purging your bodies of vain discriminations. Fourth, avoid pondering things in your mind, thereby purging your bodies of discriminatory cognition. A single moment's dualistic thought is sufficient to drag you back to the 12-fold chain of causation. It is ignorance which turns the wheel of causation, thereby creating an endless chain of karmic causes and results. This is the law which governs our whole lives up to the time of senility and death. In this connection, we are told that Sudhana, after vainly seeking Bodhi in 110 places within the 12-fold causal sphere, at last encountered Maitreya, who sent him to Manjushri. Manjushri here represents your primordial ignorance of reality. If, as thought succeeds thought, you go on seeking for wisdom outside yourselves, then there is a continual process of thoughts arising, dying away, and being succeeded by others. And that is why all you monks go on experiencing birth, old age, sickness, and death, building up karma, which produces corresponding effects. For such is the arising and passing away of the five bubbles, or, in other words, the five skandhas. Ah, could you but restrain each single thought from arising, then would the 18 sense realms be made to vanish. How godlike, then, your bodily rewards, and how exalted the knowledge that would dawn within your minds. A mind like that could be called the terrace of the spirit. But while you remain lost in attachments, you condemn your bodies to be corpses, or, as it is sometimes expressed, to be lifeless corpses inhabited by demons. 45. Question. Vimalakirti dwells in silence. Manjushri offers praise. How can they have really entered the gateway of non-duality? Answer. The gateway of non-duality is your original mind. Speech and silence are relative concepts belonging to the ephemeral sphere. When nothing is said, nothing is manifested. That is why Manjushri offered praise. Question. Vimalakirti did not speak. Does this imply that sound is subject to cessation? Answer. Speech and silence are one. There is no distinction between them. Therefore, it is written, neither the true nature nor the root of Manjushri's hearing are subject to cessation. Thus, the sound of the Tathagata's voice is everlasting, nor can there be any such reality as the time before he began to preach or the time after he finished preaching. The preaching of the Tathagata is identical with the Dharma he taught, for there is no distinction between the preaching and the thing preached, just as there is none between such varied phenomena as the glorified and revealed bodies of a Buddha, the Bodhisattvas, the Shravakas, the world systems with their mountains and rivers or water, birds, trees, forests, and the rest. The preaching of the Dharma is at one and the same time both vocal and silent. Though one talks all day long, no word is spoken. This being so, only silence belongs to the essential. 46. Question. Is it true that the Shravakas can only merge their forms into the formless sphere which still belongs to the transitory triple world, and that they are incapable of losing themselves utterly in Bodhi? Answer. Yes. Form implies matter. Those saints are only proficient in casting off worldly views and activities, by which means they escape from worldly delusions and afflictions. They cannot lose themselves utterly in Bodhi. Thus, there is still the danger that demons may come and pluck them from within the orbit of Bodhi itself. Aloofly seated in their forest dwellings, they perceive the Bodhi mind but vaguely. Whereas those who are vowed to become Bodhisattvas and who are already within the Bodhi of the three worlds neither reject nor grasp at anything. Non-grasping, it were vain to seek them upon any plane. Non-rejecting, demons will strive in vain to find them. Nevertheless, with the merest desire to attach yourselves to this or that, A mental symbol is soon formed, such symbols in turn giving rise to all those sacred writings which lead you back to undergo the various kinds of rebirth. So let your symbolic conception be that of a void, for then the wordless teaching of Zen will make itself apparent to you. Know only that you must decide to eschew all symbolizing whatever, for by this eschewal is symbolized the great void in which there is neither unity nor multiplicity. That void which is not really void, that symbol which is no symbol. Then will the Buddhas of all the vast world systems manifest themselves to you in a flash. You will recognize the hosts of squirming, wriggling, sentient beings as no more than shadows. Continents as innumerable as grains of dust will seem no more to you than a single drop in the great ocean. To you, the profoundest doctrines ever heard will seem but dreams and illusions. You will recognize all minds as one and behold all things as one, including those thousands of sacred books and myriads of pious commentaries. All of them are just your one mind. Could you but cease your groping after forms, all these true perceptions would be yours. Therefore, it is written, within the thusness of the one mind, the various means to enlightenment are no more than showy ornaments. 47. Question. But what if in previous lives I have behaved like Kali Raja, slicing the limbs from living men? Answer. The holy sages tortured by him represent your own mind, while Kali Raja symbolizes that part of you which goes out seeking. Such unkingly behavior is called lust for personal advantage. If you students of the way, without making any attempt to live virtuously, just want to make a study of everything you perceive, then how are you different from him? By allowing your gaze to linger on a form, you wrench out the eyes of a sage, yourself. And when you linger upon a sound, you slice off the ears of a sage. Thus it is with all your senses and with cognition, for their varied perceptions are called slicers. Question. When we meet all suffering with sage-like patience and avoid all mind-slicing perceptions, that which suffers with resignation surely cannot be the one mind, for that cannot be subject to the endurance of pain. Answer. You are one of those people who force the unbecoming into conceptual molds, such as the concept of patient suffering, or the concept of seeking nothing outside yourself. Thereby, you do yourself violence. Question. When the holy sages were dismembered, were they conscious of pain? And if among them there were no entities capable of suffering, who or what did suffer? Answer. If you are not suffering pain now, what is the point of chiming in like that? 48. Question. Did Dhammacara Buddha attain his intuition of reality within a single 500-year period or not? Answer. There is no attaining it within such a period. You must never forget that this so-called attaining of intuition implies neither a withdrawal from daily life nor a search for enlightenment. You have just to understand that time periods have no real existence. Hence, the attainment of the vital intuition occurs neither within nor without a 500-year period. Question. Is it not possible to attain the omniscience in which all the events of past, present, and future are known to us? Answer. There is absolutely nothing which can be attained. Question. How long is a cycle of 500 yugas? Answer. One such period should be ample for you to become a liberated sage. For when Dhammacara Buddha attained his intuitive knowledge of the Dharma, there was not really a grain of anything attainable. 49. Question. The sutras teach that the fettering of passions and illusions produced during millions of kalpas is a sufficient means of obtaining the Dharmakaya, even without going through the stage of being monks. What does this mean? Answer. If you practice means of attaining enlightenment for three myriad eons, but without losing your belief in something really attainable, you will still be as many eons from your goal as there are grains of sand in the Ganges. But if, by a direct perception of the Dharmakaya's true nature, you grasp it in a flash, you will have reached the highest goal taught in the three vehicles. Why? Because the belief that the Dharmakaya can be obtained belongs to the doctrines of those sects which do not understand the truth. 50. Question. If, on perceiving a phenomena, I gain a sudden comprehension of it, is that tantamount to understanding Bodhidharma's meaning? Answer. Bodhidharma's mind penetrated even beyond the void. Question. Then individual objects do exist? Answer. The existence of things as separate entities and not as separate entities are both dualistic concepts. As Bodhidharma said, there are separate entities and there are not, but at the same time, they are neither the one nor the other, for relativity is transient. If you disciples cannot get beyond those incorrect orthodox teachings, why do you call yourselves Zen monks? I exhort you to apply yourselves solely to Zen and not to go seeking after wrong methods which only result in a multiplicity of concepts. A man drinking water knows well enough if it is cold or warm. Whether you will be walking or sitting, you must restrain all discriminatory thoughts from one moment to the next. If you do not, you will never escape the chain of rebirth. 51. Question. If the Buddha really dwells in matchless tranquility beyond the multiplicity of forms, how is it that his body yielded 84 pecks of relics? Answer. If you really think like that, you are confusing the transitory relics with the real. Question. Are there really such things as sariras? Or are they the Buddha's accumulated merits? Answer. There are no such things. They are not merits. Question. Then, why is it written, the Buddha relics are ethereal and subtle, the golden ones are indestructible? What does your reverence say to that? Answer. If you harbor such beliefs, why call yourself a student of Zen? Can you imagine bones in the void? The minds of all the Buddhas are one with the great void. What bones do you expect to find there? Question. But if I had actually seen some of these relics, what then? Answer. You would have seen the products of your own wrong thinking. Question. Does your reverence have any of those relics? Please, let us see them. Answer. A true relic would be hard to see. To find it, you would have to crush mighty Mount Sumeru to fine dust using only your bare hands. 52. The Master said, only when your minds cease dwelling upon anything whatsoever will you come to an understanding of the true way of Zen. I may express it thus. The way of the Buddhas flourishes in a mind utterly freed from conceptual thought processes, while discrimination between this and that gives birth to a legion of demons. Finally, remember that from the first to the last, not even the smallest grain of anything perceptible has ever existed or ever will exist. 53. Question. to whom did the patriarch silently transmit the Dharma? Answer. No Dharma was transmitted to anybody. Question. Then why did the second patriarch ask Bodhidharma for the transmission of mind? Answer. If you hold that something was transmitted, you imply that the second patriarch reached mind by seeking. But no amount of seeking can ever lead to mind, so we talk of only transmitting mind to you. If you really get something, you will find yourself back on the wheel of life and death. 54. Question. Did the Buddha pierce right through the primordial darkness of ignorance? Answer. Yes. The primordial darkness is the sphere in which every Buddha achieves enlightenment. Thus, the very sphere in which karma arises may be called a bodhimandala. Every grain of matter, every appearance, is one with eternal and immutable reality. Wherever your foot may fall, you are still within that sanctuary for enlightenment, though it is nothing perceptible. I assure you that one who comprehends the truth of nothing to be attained is already seated in the sanctuary where he will gain his enlightenment. Question. Is primordial ignorance bright or dark? Answer. It is neither. Both terms are dualistic. Primordial ignorance is at once neither bright nor dark. And by the non-bright is meant just that original brightness, which is above the distinction made between bright and dark. Just this one sentence is enough to give most people a headache. That is why we say the world is full of vexations arising from the transitory phenomena around us. Though, like Sariputra, we were all to strain our minds trying to discover a means of liberation, that would be no way to fathom the wisdom and omniscience by which the Buddhas transcend all space. There can be no argument about it. Once, when Gotama had measured out 3,000 chiliocosms, a bodhisattva suddenly appeared and passed over them in a single stride. Yet even that prodigious stride failed to cover the width of one pore of Samantabhadra's skin. Now, what sort of mental attainments have you that will help you to study the meaning of that? Question. But if such things are entirely unlearnable, why is it written, on returning to our original nature, we transcend duality, but the relative means form many gates to the truth? Answer. We return to our original nature beyond duality, which in fact is also the real nature of the universe of primordial darkness, which again is the Buddha nature. The relative means, forming many gates, applies to Shravakas, who hold that our universe is subject to becoming and cessation, and to Pratyeka Buddhas, who, though acknowledging the infinity of its past, regard it as subject to future destruction, so they all concentrate entirely on the means of overcoming it. But the real Buddhas perceived that the becoming and destruction of the sentient world are both one with eternity. In another sense, there is no becoming or cessation. To perceive all this is to be truly enlightened. Thus, nirvana and enlightenment are one. When the lotus opened and the universe lay disclosed, there arose the duality of absolute and sentient world, or rather, the absolute appeared in two aspects which, taken together, comprise pure perfection. These aspects are unchanging reality and potential form. For sentient beings, there are such pairs of opposites as becoming and cessation, together with all the others. Therefore, beware of clinging to one half of a pair. Those who, in their single-minded attempt to reach Buddhahood, detest the sentient world, thereby blaspheme all the Buddhas of the universe. The Buddhas, on manifesting themselves in the world, seized dung shovels to rid themselves of all such rubbish as books containing metaphysics and sophistry. My advice to you is to rid yourselves of all your previous ideas about studying mind or perceiving it. When you are rid of them, you will no longer lose yourselves amid sophistries. Regard the process exactly as you would regard the shoveling of dung. Yes, my advice is to give up all indulgence in conceptual thought and intellectual processes. When such things no longer trouble you, you will unfailingly reach supreme enlightenment. On no account make a distinction between the absolute and the sentient world. As a real student of Cao Si Zen, you must make no distinctions of any kind. From the earliest times, the sages have taught that a minimum of activity is the gateway of their Dharma. So let no activity be the gateway of my Dharma. Such is the gateway of the one mind. But all who reach this gate fear to enter. I do not teach a doctrine of extinction. Few understand this, but those who do understand are the only ones to become Buddhas. Treasure this gem. 55. Question. But how can we prevent ourselves from falling into the error of making distinctions between this and that? Answer. By realizing that, though you eat the whole day through, no single grain has passed your lips, and that a day's journey has not taken you a single step forward. Also, by uniformly abstaining from such notions as self and other. Do not permit the events of your daily lives to bind you, but never withdraw yourselves from them. Only by acting thus can you earn the title of a liberated one. Never allow yourselves to mistake outward appearance for reality. Avoid the error of thinking in terms of past, present, and future. The past has not gone. The present is a fleeting moment. The future is not yet to come. When you practice mind control, sit in the proper position, stay perfectly tranquil, and do not permit the least movement of your minds to disturb you. This alone is what is called liberation. Ah, be diligent, be diligent. Of 1,000 or 10,000 attempting to enter by this gate, only 3 or perhaps 5 pass through. If you are heedless of my warnings, calamity is sure to follow. Therefore, it is written, exert your strength in this life to attain, or else incur long eons of further pain. The master passed away on this mountain during the Taichung reign of the Tang Dynasty. The emperor Xuanzong bestowed upon him the posthumous title of the Zen master who destroys all limitations. The memorial pagoda is known as the Tower of Spacious Karma. Conclusion. The Wanling Record of Zen Master Huangbo. End Part 3.